Welcome to our conversation today. I'm Tom Schrupp, Chief Physician Officer for CenterCare, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Drs. Jesse Roski and Jack Lyons. They're both physician leaders and clinicians. I'll ask you to tell us a little bit about yourselves today.
Thanks, Tom. My name is Jesse Roski. You guys might have heard me on some of these before, and I'm privileged to be asked to do one again. I'm one of the internal medicine hospitalists at St. Cloud, and I also have an administrative role as the medical director of performance improvement. But the clinical background is really what's relevant today. I'm an internal medicine physician by training. I'm Minnesota born and bred. I was trained through the University of Minnesota all the way. And CenterCare is my first position outside of residency, and I am coming into my 10th year doing this. In the pandemic, the hospitalist group, and including myself, we've been the main staff physicians for the non-ICU COVID ward, so the Med 1 ward that we have.
My name is Jack Lyons. I'm an ICU doctor here at the St. Cloud Hospital with CenterCare. Like Dr. Roski, I am a born and bred Minnesotan. I grew up in Duluth. Went to medical school at the University of Minnesota Duluth and did my internal medicine residency at Hennepin County Medical Center, and then stayed there for fellowship training in critical care medicine. I started here at St. Cloud Hospital in September of 2019 and have been working as our director of the intensivist services since about this time last year as the physician in charge of the ICU docs, of course, during COVID in that time.
Well, thank you. Again, thanks for joining today. We're going to talk about a topic that tends to bring on strong emotions and opinions, and that's the use of a medication named ivermectin. And I'd just like you to, if you would, just as physicians taking this from a high level, when you hear that word ivermectin, what comes to mind for you? Let's start with Jesse.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is just all of the conversation that's happening in the lay press and in social media. And, you know, I reflect that it's like people feel the need to have some closer access to things they have control in this really uncertain time where there's so little we have control over. And I give people a lot of credit for their efforts to really get deep in and try to understand and try to advocate for themselves. I think what's really unfortunate to me is that there's a lot of information floating around that sounds really credible and compelling, but it's just cringeworthy for some of it, how just unfortunate and how bad some of the science is. I think the answer is not really known yet. There's still credible, good science underway, but the stuff that's making it out into conversation has just been widely discredited. And so far, there's nothing to really make a conclusion on. One of the common studies we're hearing people cite, when they dug into the details, they took the same data for patients and they copied it over and over and over and claimed that they had a 600-person strong study. And then the publishing entity retracted it. And the same thing happened with one in Argentina that's, quoted a lot. The hospital where it supposedly happened said they never heard of it. And so it's like, I don't know the true story. Obviously, I've not been to Argentina and seen what's going on and why they claimed this science. But it just is, there's no credible science out there yet. So I think we still all have a lot of questions. And, Jack, some of the studies look interesting, these ones that are supposed to be randomized controlled trials, so the sort of the gold standard of medicine, just they don't hold up. But there's some out there that look kind of interesting, some of the observational studies and stuff. I mean, I think there's some theories going on around why ivermectin might possibly seem to have some benefit, especially in Latin America. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what we might find when we get deeper into the science here.
Yeah, I think it's an important topic. And I think as we discuss it today, there are two halves of the conversation to have. I think you and I are well versed in the poor quality of evidence available. And we'll talk about that. And you mentioned some of the more famous studies that are now discredited. But I liked your first point, the acknowledgement that we would do anything under the sun to fix COVID or to make it go away or to take care of these people that are dying in front of us. And I think that's the emotional part of the idea that ivermectin is almost a charged word. That's what drives it, is this desperation to get people better, to get families better, to get families back together, to get the loved ones out of the hospital. And I don't think this is a surprise, we'll refute some of the studies that are more popular or talk about how ivermectin is not data supported at the time. I do want to start by acknowledging that it comes from this place of wanting your loved one to get better. And that's where the questions come from. And that's where the questions from patient families and our own nursing staff come from, is just the lack of good treatments we have available and the desperation to get through this somehow. You had mentioned in some of the more favorable studies, if there are any, seem to come from Latin America and other places in the world that, interestingly, have a high helminth infestation problem. And so helminth is a worm. And one of the reasons that we're seeing folks buy ivermectin, or one of the ways we see folks buy ivermectin, is as a horse dewormer. Folks can buy it at Fleet Farm, places like that. And one of the ways we're seeing people get hurt by ivermectin is by taking veterinary dose ivermectin and trying to use it as a person. The helminth hypothesis, which I think is very interesting, seems to suggest that in places of the world that have a relatively high worm infestation, so these aren't like earthworms that you'd use to go fishing or in your garden, these are worms that infect humans, treating patients with ivermectin while receiving corticosteroids may improve their outcomes. And so the reason for that is, in folks who are infected with worms, a dose of steroids, which has been shown again and again to be helpful in COVID, so it is now considered standard of care in treating respiratory failure secondary to COVID. Steroids have the unfortunate side effect of worsening a worm infestation, or causing those worms to start to migrate and cause trouble in lungs especially. And so if you had, say, a quiescent or you had a worm infestation but were doing fine, and then got put on a dose of steroids, that worm infestation to your lungs could get a lot worse. And so those folks, in that very specific circumstance, chunks of the world with a high lung worm infection rate, which is certainly not the case here in the U.S., but other chunks of the world, may benefit from a dose of ivermectin while getting steroids.
I think, yeah, we want to emphasize it's not our patient population. So, you know, the question then still is, in the absence of a helminth infection, could ivermectin have any benefit on COVID in and of itself? And that's the answer that there really is, so far, no credible evidence to support. But, you know, I think we should emphasize that we, as you pointed out, we're seeing this death and destruction in front of us, and we'd give anything to have a miracle cure too. And I really want an answer about ivermectin. And I'm really happy that right now there's three really well-designed, high-quality randomized controlled trials underway. And one of them's at the University of Minnesota. They enroll there. So if, you know, one of my patients qualified for it, I would be more than happy to refer them. The challenge is right now that population that they're enrolling are outpatients. So for you and I, when the situation has become so charged and the patients are so critically ill, it's really not on the table there. And I think, so then you say, well, why wouldn't we just give it? You know, maybe it's a miracle. Maybe some of the science is onto something. Why can't we just give it to them? What's it going to hurt? And I think with the absence of any evidence of benefit, we have to think about the harm we might inadvertently cause. And the helminth population, or the helminth hypothesis, certainly doesn't apply to our patient population. So if that's where the benefit is, that's not going to be present in our patient population. But then the harm still could be there. And, you know, I've seen some of the stuff about the harm that can happen. You mentioned the veterinary doses. I don't know that we saw any of that here, but I've seen some of the case reports about it, right, Jack, about what can happen with those humongous doses.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing many, many case reports of toxicity, mild cases or nausea, vomiting, headache, those kinds of things. But severe cases can lead to seizure, and as we all know, seizure can, in rare circumstances, lead to death. And so often we get asked the question by our staff and by patient families, well, what's the harm? And it's worth pointing out there is real potential for harm in trying it. And so that's, we've got to do better in terms of data than, well, it's unlikely to hurt you, it might help. And in this case, we're not even there. In this case, it's, well, it might hurt you, and there's no data yet to suggest it will help.
Yeah, and I think we've been in some really charged circumstances because there are people out there who are really claiming this is a miracle cure. And, you know, I think, I don't know their motives. And, you know, we're taught, it's an important part of our culture that we have to assume positive intent. But I can't help notice that, you know, like the board certified doctors who will, offer an ivermectin prescription will sell their telehealth visit. And I mean, you know, telehealth is a service. You should get paid for when you do it. But they're basically selling a telehealth visit where somebody says, hey, I have a positive COVID test. And then they give them an ivermectin prescription and it's $90. And I mean, to me, it just reeks of financial conflict of interest. And it just seems like the snake oil salesmen that are trying to take care of the tragedy that you and I are trying to take advantage of the tragedy that you and I are seeing every day.
I agree. I mean, you know, I frankly have very little respect for those folks that are using this crisis to make a buck off of people's insecurities selling ivermectin. I think that's, I mean, in the retelling of the COVID story, when hopefully someday we've recovered, I don't think that we're going to look back fondly on those physicians.
I think it's pretty, the kind of the lowest end of losing our ethical North Star and our tenets of integrity when you're willing to, you know, capitalize on people's hope in a time when they're so desperate. And, you know, I think we can acknowledge there are still questions to be asked, but I'm just so frankly angry at how this is turning up distrust and turning up the wrong emotions. And I mean, we have nothing to gain by withholding it. You know, it's not like, in fact, it's an awful lot harder to not give somebody ivermectin because it means it takes an awful lot of energy to try to keep the trust of the patient and their family as we try to explain all this.
I couldn't agree more. Dr. Schrupp, do you have any insight here?
Yeah, I was just going to touch a little bit on ethics. You know, the public has heard the phrase oftentimes, first do no harm. Mm-hmm. excuse me. And so that's relevant here, given what Dr. Roski said. And so then if we're moving on to what can help, if some of these studies seem to show benefit and others don't, how is a layperson to know, you know, what to believe? I know Dr. Roski spoke a little bit about the poor quality studies earlier. Why is a study not a study? Who would like to take that one? Why aren't all studies, even, you know, there's the extreme example of fabricating data where the hospital said it didn't even happen, but why are some studies better than others?
Well, I think so. The gold standard is, you know, the randomized controlled trial, which means you say we're going to give the intervention to one group and not give the intervention to the other. So that's the control word. And then being randomized means you're going to take every patient that comes through the door, and it doesn't matter any characteristic about them. There's no bias. Nobody knows where they're going to end up. They just might end up in one arm or the other. The patient doesn't know. Their treating provider doesn't know. You remove the possibility of placebo effect. You remove the possibility of unconscious bias in how you're treating the patient or what they perceive. And you're just looking objectively at outcomes. So a lot of them aren't randomized controlled trials, the stuff that's out there. Some of them are observational, which means, you know, intrinsically there's the possibility you just automatically are seeing some two different patient populations, and then you're trying to extrapolate, even though there was already something fundamentally different about that patient population. Like one population was less sick than the other. Well, how can you tell if it was because they were less sick or because of the intervention that one of them got and the other one didn't? The other thing that can be hard about this is some studies choose meaningless endpoints. So, you know, some of the studies will say, well, when does the PCR test end up negative for COVID? And they'll say it's, you know, negative one day sooner, which is one of the studies said that, and it wasn't even statistically significant. You know, that means that it could have just happened by chance that one of these groups cleared their PCR one day faster than the other. But that also doesn't matter. I mean, like, I care if my patient's getting better. I want a mortality benefit. I want less time on the vent. I want a person who survives the discharge to the hospital. I want less hospitalizations. Those are the endpoints that matter. So a well-designed study needs to have a clinically meaningful endpoint. And this is where, again, to just circle way back to the beginning, we respect so much that people are advocating for themselves, and how scary this time is, are leading people to try to figure things out for themselves. But I spent 11 years in training and almost 10 years in practice. Jack's got a similar track. We have our infectious disease specialists. We have 40 hospitalists, several ICU providers. We have all of our pharmacists, hundreds of years of training, trying to figure out the complexity of how science works. And I'm not trying to belittle anybody's intelligence. I mean, I know our patient population, there's some very smart people. And I know that they can be very well read, and they're reading a lot on the internet, but that is just not a substitute for being trained and to try to evaluate the quality of the medical science.
Thank you, Jesse. And if I could just ask Jack, why from your perspective, and I've been in some of these conversations where it's so crucial for the family to advocate for patients, say, who can't speak for themselves, who's on a ventilator. Why is it so important for doctors to go back to science? What is that? Why is that so visceral for doctors? And Jesse, I'd appreciate your thoughts as well.
As you point out, these are such emotionally charged conversations. And these are conversations where families would do anything to see their loved one get better. And in a way, you can't help them. You couldn't blame anyone. If they see on the internet or on Facebook or TV, what have you, a miracle drug or a medicine that would get their loved one better, well, they couldn't sleep at night if they didn't do everything they could to advocate for she or he getting better, including ivermectin or any of the other therapies that we've been asked to try. As the doctor, as the provider at the bedside in that situation, I've got to do everything I can to make a decision that's grounded in data and evidence, and to strip the emotion from it. And it's not because I want to devalue the emotion that the family is bringing to the conversation. It's that it's my job to try to be objective about something that is so emotionally charged. And so as physicians, if we allow ourselves to make emotionally charged decisions, we lose all footing in evidence-based medicine, in data-driven diagnoses, treatments, therapies. And then we're kind of rudderless. And so while I understand why families have to advocate for these therapies, it's in a way that conversation is naturally set up to have some tension. They have to advocate for this. And I, because the data doesn't support it, in a way, I have to say no. Not because I don't want it to work, not because I'm unfeeling, or because I hide in my behind books and numbers, but because that's the way medicine and science works. And if I allow emotion to make clinical decisions, my patients will be worse off.
Yeah, we'll end up hurting somebody. And I think, we have had an open mind through this whole thing. This is an illness we had never seen before, though we've seen things similar to it, but nothing to this size or scope or the specific behavior of this. And we've learned, and we keep learning, you know, so the idea that remdesivir might provide a little benefit, but then next, you know, the idea that dexamethasone certainly does, learning how clot prone COVID is and how much anticoagulation can make it different. A different outcome. And more recently, just really creative, interesting things like fluvoxamine, which is an antidepressant, can change some of the inflammatory immune system behavior. And an early mild COVID, maybe that can help. You know, we're always looking and open for answers, but there has to be some evidence base that this is going to work. And, you know, we keep sort of, I don't know, grasping at straws. You know, first it was hydroxychloroquine, and then it, you know, then it's ivermectin, and we want a miracle, and we just don't have one. I mean, I guess I don't know that we want to go down this rabbit hole today, but with the exception of the prevention, and this isn't a conversation about the vaccine today, but I think we just want to, I want to kind of wrap up by making sure that anybody in the community listening who's not seeing what's going on in the hospital, things are dreadful. And if you, are willing to, for yourself and for your loved ones and for your neighbors, please consider getting vaccinated. But if you don't want to yet, you know, we respect that. You have, just back to that very beginning, you have questions and you're advocating for yourself. If you aren't willing to get vaccinated yet, please just take care, wear a mask, try to respect the health care colleagues and partners and neighbors you might have and what they're going through. And do what you can to care for each other and care for our neighbors and take care for the vulnerable among us.
Jack and Jesse, one of the things that's occurred to me in some of these challenging conversations with families about the use of ivermectin is the breakdown in the therapeutic relationship or trust in the physician or the medical team. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with that and how that's been a barrier?
Yeah. I will first start by acknowledging that that is very, very true, unfortunately. As we talked about, families have to advocate for their loved one. Ivermectin is one of those things that many families feel compelled to advocate for very strongly. It comes up regularly with patient families, with me, in varying degrees of tension. At times it's a question, and I'll answer that the data doesn't support it, and conversation moves on, and we don't come back to it. At other times, I think it's okay to admit we at the hospital have been threatened with lawsuits. I've had families walk out on me, hang up on me. You know, that it stops the conversation until it's resolved. In those interactions, I will admit the easiest thing to do would be to say, okay, fine, we'll use it. But that's not right. That has the potential to cause harm, and there's no data, credible data, to show that it will help. And so I'm obligated to hold firm and to say that we won't use it, and we can't use it, and we shouldn't use it. And then the challenging part of the conversation begins, to say, I would do anything to get your loved one better, but this isn't it. This might hurt them. And I hope that we can work together going forward, that I can earn a relationship of trust with you so that you can come to believe that I am doing the best available for your partner, your child, your parent, to get them through this. And if eventually, if we can build that relationship together, You can come to trust me that ivermectin isn't the right therapy for your loved one here. I'll admit that doesn't always work, but I will say that, and I will say that almost verbatim to families. I understand you have to ask me. You have to ask me these questions to advocate for your loved one in the hopes that we can get through this together. I need you to know I would do anything to help your partner get better. But ivermectin isn't it.
Yeah, I think I So what I struggle with is, you know, I'm on the ethics committee as well, and that's helped me a lot because it means that every decision that's hard, I can try to fall back on our original tenets and try to remove the emotion from the situation and say, am I being guided to do the right thing? And, you know, the original Hippocratic Oath included the line that I love, into whatsoever houses we enter, we will enter to help the sick. And I think there are really complicated reasons as to why trust in healthcare professionals has been eroded. And it's not just recent. I mean, this is the worst of the stress test, but I mean, you can go back to like the Laetrile crisis of the 70s when people were convinced we were hiding the cure for cancer. I don't know why there's a broader distrust of institutions. And right now, there's no institution more at the forefront than healthcare. So I think the distrust is manifesting there. But I guess I would ask our patients to remember that, you know, we're your neighbors, we're your community members, family members. CentraCare is actually, you know, an organization that's basically in a small town. And you trusted us before. You know, you would have a family practice doctor you had from cradle to the grave. You were critically ill, being cared for by me or Jack in septic shock. And I said, you needed antibiotics and we need pressors. And then we're going to have to call a surgeon and we're going to have to do anesthesia and we're going to have to remove your gallbladder. And those are very, very high stakes decisions. And I'm confident in the advice I'm giving and in my training and in the science I have access to. And once upon a time, you trusted me on that. And I don't know if you'll believe me, but we don't have ulterior motives. We really, truly just want this to end. And we want the people in front of us, our neighbors, sometimes our family members, we just want them to be well. And we want this suffering to end.
Thank you. Jesse and Jack, any last thoughts?
I want to thank you for providing the space to have this conversation.
Well, thank
you. I need to end with the idea that we would do anything to help our patients get better. We are coming to these trials and these studies with an open mind, and so far, ivermectin hasn't been shown to work. Steroids have been shown to work. Vaccine is tremendously effective. But know that we would do anything under the sun to get our patients better.
I know that, Jack, and I know that about you as well, Jesse. I'd really like to thank you so much for joining us today as guests with your wisdom. Thank you so much, Drs. Jesse Roski and Dr. Jack Lyons, and have a wonderful day.